Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
We're going to continue today's section, which I was hoping we would complete. I don't know that we will. I found the final piece that Rav Hirsch has in putting his approach together to have been the most complex and confusing. I read and reread these last two pages 6-7 times, trying to get clear on what he is saying. I think I have it. I'm sure we will get it better as we go through it together, and we'll work it through. So what I'd like to do is give a little bit of an introduction that I have put together based on everything that he's saying, but I think with the more that we know in advance going in, the easier we will find reading through what he's about to say. Let's read the psukim inside. The last three psukim that we have to do. Let's summarize where we're up to. No, I don't want to summarize the whole thing. Just reading verses 5 and 6. Hey and Vav is where we last left off. Verse Hey, Vayered Hashem Liros Esfair V'yasham Migdol Asher Bonu B'nei Ha'odam, that Hashem descended to look at the city and the tower which the sons of man built. And Rav Hirsch had pointed out that the concept of Hashem descending is the concept that the Iker Shechina B'tachtonim, the primary place that Hashem desires to dwell or cause to dwell His presence, is down here. It's not up in the heavens. He wants to be down here. And therefore when He sees a problem that mankind is pulling away, that's where we find the concept of Vayered, where Hashem then, so to speak, descends to where man is to bring them back, so to speak. So the concept of Hashem descending, He already is here with us. It means mankind's desire to push farther away, and God descending to, I want to be with you. You keep moving farther, and I'm going to come to do what I need to do to bring you back. And the context in which Rav Hirsch was describing is that this idea of the individual, the desire of the group of this Tower of Babel, they're putting the institution, the community, ahead of the individual, saying that everything is here for the group, and we will accomplish at the expense of the individual. If you recall the very powerful statement that Rav Hirsch quoted from Chazal, from the sages, that if a brick fell and was smashed, the people would sit and mourn the loss of the brick because now the project would be halted, whereas if a man fell and died, they just pushed him aside and kept on going. That in that way, the sages encompassed the thought process of, we will accomplish, the individual will be consumed in the quest of the group, and that the group becomes more powerful than the individual, which is true. This is just a corruption of that concept. Now the Torah wants the individuals to put together their powers into a group dynamic so that the group dynamic then gives back its power to the individuals. The corruption of that, if you remember, just want to repeat this, I said this at a Sheva Brachos, and everybody loved the idea that the Nasi, the leader, is like the cloud. Remember you said about how the cloud, why does this Torah use the same word for cloud that it uses for a prince or for a leader? Nasi is both a cloud and a prince. And Rav Hirsch understood because the cloud gathers all the water from the earth in its evaporated form into the cloud, but it doesn't gather all of that for itself. It then bestows it back to the earth in the form of Gishmei Bracha, of the rains of blessings. And so a cloud is a gathering of all of the potential powers underneath and then bestowing it back to the people, not keeping it for itself. That's what a true Jewish leader is. One who becomes very powerful because he's holding all of the potential, all of the power, all of the strengths and talents of his people, but not because he's taking it for himself to then go do what he wants to do. It's because then he, as the repository of that power, knows how and when to bestow it back to the people. That's what a leader is. That's what a community creates, a group of people who have that power of the group, of all the individuals, and then the individuals gain from the community. And this corruption of that concept was all the individuals giving themselves to the community, but the community taking it for itself, not for the individual, but just taking it from the individual, and the individual sacrifices his life to the entity as opposed to gaining his life by being attached to the entity. That was, in a nutshell, the way that Rav Hirsch understood what is going on in this particular episode. So Vayered Hashem, so Hashem comes down because he sees the destruction of mankind. The idea that the individual will become meaningless, that the individual is simply a small cog and it can be dispensed with whenever we need him, is the destruction of the society that God wanted to be in the world, and therefore he comes down to try to bring it back. And Vav in 6, Vayomer Hashem, Hein Am Echad V'Safa Achas L'Kulam. He says, behold, look, they are one people and they have one language. V'Zeh HaChilam. And this is what they do with that power. This is what they do with the uniting or unifying power of having a single language. This is what they use that for. Lo Yibotzer Mehem Kol Asher Yozmu L'Asos. Nothing will be withholden from them, which they propose to do. Rav Hirsch has a lot to say in this puzzle in terms of working out the details of the language, but I'm going to leave that aside because his concluding verses are so rich, and I'd like to spend time on that. Okay, that leads us up to where we are up to. And this is all just going to be introduction to actually reading what he wants to say. What are the final three verses of the story? What does Hashem then do, given this circumstance? 7, 9, Hava Nirda, again, let us descend. Now, what we're going to do here is going to be, I'm trying to give an introduction which will be clarifying. What I'm about to do is confuse you. But it's important to see it this way, to appreciate what Rav Hirsch is going to do. So let me give an introduction to my introduction so that you're not confused by my introduction. Does that make sense? Are we going backwards enough steps to try to get forward? If you look in the English, you're going to see the word confused used twice in verses 7, 8, and 9. Let's just read the English. Again, I'm doing this so that we don't get confused, even though this is going to confuse you. Come, let us descend and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. That's how the English would read. That what was God's purpose? To confuse their language. Now, what I want to point out, Rav Hirsch's entire approach is going to be that you have to be very careful when you translate words. As we've seen, he's a very tremendously gifted linguist, and that his interpretations come from his nuanced understanding of the words that the Chumash uses. So in Rav Hirsch's world, the words used are very particular. And if we're going to find the same English word used twice for confuse, which we're going to read, we had better find the same Hebrew word corresponding to that, right? And we had better find that the usage of the word confused is an accurate translation of the Hebrew words chosen. Because we know that Rav Hirsch is very careful that the Hebrew words used are the key to understanding the story. So we're going to read the English, and then we'll see if we find, in fact, those same words on the Hebrew side, and whether or not it's an accurate translation. Then we'll go back and see that Rav Hirsch is not going to like this English translation one bit. And then, with the understanding, we'll see what he's going to do. So I'm doing all this to see where he's coming from to come to his understanding. So the English would read as follows, as we have it in the sheet that I gave you, at least. Let us descend and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. What would it mean to confuse their language? In terms of the English word confuse. So Rav Hirsch is bothered to confuse a language. What is going on? What exists right now? We all have one language. What would it mean to confuse? That's a funny word. Really what we want to do is not confuse. We want to create new languages. Confuse is a funny English word if everybody speaks the same language. Right now, what I want to do is, if I'm going to give you a new language so that you don't understand me anymore, is that confusing language or is that creating new language?
Both. When I hear the word confused, I think of being confused in the mind.
Excellent. Right? So, the goal doesn't... The English word used, when Hashem says what His plan is, doesn't yet... will it or will it not fit what the purpose is, which seems to be to create new languages? Yes? No? Agreed? Yeah? So far so good?
Yeah.
Okay, but the English as we have it would read as follows. Let us descend and confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. And Hashem dispersed them from there over the face of the earth, and they stopped building the city, which we pointed out. What do you mean He dispersed them? This was one of the original questions that we had asked. He went down to confuse their language, but what the pasuk says He did was disperse them. Which one really came first, and what was the plan? Was the plan to confuse their language, or was the plan to disperse them? And how did that work from off each other? Therefore it was called Bavel, because it was there that Hashem confused the language of all the earth. And from there Hashem scattered them over the face of the earth. Okay, so now the English word confused appears twice. It appears in verse 7, let us descend and there confuse their language. And in verse 9, it was called Bavel because there Hashem confused the language. So the English story, if you were only reading in English, would be pretty straightforward. Problem is, which words do you find on the Hebrew side of the page? In Zion, in verse 7, Hava means come, Nerda, let us descend, Vinavla Sham Sifasam. Now, Navla comes from the Shoresh. You have it on your, if, on your sheet you have in front of you. So again, you have to, this was like last minute, I was going to use the board, so I ended up with the sheets that wasn't done the way that it. There's an extra word, Arev, on the top here. You could just cross it out and ignore that. I don't want that to be there. There are two columns here. One that starts with the word Arev, then Balal, then Pilel or Palal. And the second column you have Naval and Nafal. These are all separate roots and separate words. Which word of those five would you say is the root of the word in verse Zayin, Zayin, Vinav lo sham sifasam? Naval, right? So Rav Hirsch argues that is the root of that word, a naval. Now the word naval means to wither, dry up, or eventually cause to become separated. Like basically wither or dry up is the root of that word. In verse 9, it says, Al Kain Karoshima Bavel, therefore they call the name of the place Bavel, Kisham Balal Hashem Svat Kol Haaretz. Their Hashem was Balal, their language. Which root is that? Right? Balal. That's pretty straightforward. So we have, says Rav Hirsch, two separate words describing the process. First, Hashem caused a Naval to happen. And then the name of the city is Bavel because it was Balal. It was something else. So far so good, just that there are two separate words that are used. Now what do these words mean? That's going to be really the issue. Okay. Now you can, if you have a pen and you want to just underline and highlight, in these two columns, again I wish I would have been able to have done this better for you if I had time, I realized I was going to use the board. This is, you could put a line down here. This is going to be one, on the right hand side is going to be one category of words that's going to build on each other. And the second category is going to be a separate category of words that's also going to build on each other. If you look at let's start with the first category. Arev means to cause a mixture. Like Erev, nighttime, is the beginning of the night when day and night become mixed. A ta'aroves, when we discuss, when I get questions that in my kitchen a little bit of milk fell into my meat, a ta'aroves, or I have the classic case really would be I have 10 pieces of meat in front of me and one got mixed in and now I don't know which one is which. That's a ta'aroves. It's a mixture. But the root of that type of mixture is the type of mixture in which the two components remain separate, but now they're mixed up so I can't identify which one is which. Meaning, I see 10 pieces of meat in front of me. They're clear. I don't know which one is one non-kosher piece of meat has gotten mixed up, and now they're mixed up. So I don't know which one is which. Which one is the kosher, which one is the non-kosher. It's a mixture. Balal is a different type of mixture. A balila is a mixture in which the two components have combined to form a new entity. Flour and water mix, and you now have a balila. You have a mixture. in which the addition of water to the flour causes something new and indistinguishable. You can no longer say, oh, there's a chunk of flour, I just don't know which one. The flour and the water have become something. Pilel is adding to the word bolol. You're going from the bays to a pay. And it's a stronger form of the word in which you're introducing a third party. Pilel means in Hebrew a judge. And Refersh is going to explain how we go from Arev to Balal to Pilel. We're going to get through all of that. Now, in the same way as from Balal, we added, going down that column, we changed from the bays to a pay. We went from into a stronger form of adding a new additional party. Naval and Nafal. Nafal is a word that we're familiar with, which means to fall. And Naval means to wither. Before you fall, you wither. When you're cut off from the source, we'll see Refersh is going to bring a description of a flower. When a flower is cut from the ground, first it withers, and then all the petals fall. So that the looser, lighter word of naval means to be cut off from a source to begin to wither, and it grows into, switching the bays for the pay, the stronger sense of actually then just falling apart. Okay, hopefully this isn't like, there's no big picture, this is just some of what the root words are. The main thing that we need to know for now is as follows. The Torah uses two separate words, naval, and then it uses the word balal, naval, which means to wither, which is the introductory word, which eventually means to then fall off. And the Torah also uses the word balal. There, the languages were balal, which means a mixture. It doesn't mean confuse. It means a mixture. A balila is a mixture in which you've added a new entity to the mixture. Notice a balila is always, because if I have a pot of, a bowl of flour, and I mix it around, have I accomplished anything? What creates a balila is introducing something new, which creates the mixture. Those of you who are planning on coming to the Shabbos in the kitchen class tonight, one of the main topics we're going to be discussing is creating a mixture on Shabbos. Are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to make dough by adding water to the flour? Are you allowed to make a tuna salad by adding mayonnaise to the tuna fish to create a new entity? Once, now it's just tuna fish. Now I've created, you know, with a tuna salad. Can I add water to hot chocolate powder to create chocolate milk? What are the guidelines of creating this new mixture? But by definition, I'm not just stirring the same thing up. I need to add something to the equation to create the balila. Okay, those are just some background words, which I hope was not more confusing. We're going to see it, but when we now see it in Refersh, we'll have a little bit more background. I'm only repeating what he's going to eventually say now, just that it should be a little bit more familiar with what's going on. So that if we describe the language being naval, that would mean that the language was withered, was cut off from something, leading to a total collapse of a nafila, of falling. If I say the language was bolol, then I'm saying something was added to my language which created something different or something new. So far so good? I know this is very confusing and it doesn't make any sense, but I'm hoping by confusing you now it will make more sense later. What Refersh wants to do, what he's coming to argue, is that there is no confusing going on over here. It wasn't a matter where there were two things and they got confused between each other. They forgot, I had two pieces of meat and I knew that this one was kosher, this one was non-kosher, and now I got confused which one was which. What happened was I had one language, everything was clear, and something had to have been added. The Torah doesn't use the word for confused, it uses the word for a mixture, in which there was one language, everything was the same, something was added to it, which created something new and different. So far, so good. Okay, yeah.
How did you get from Naval to Nafal? What told you to substitute?
Nothing. In other words, Refersh is going to write that you see a pattern in the Hebrew language that when you take a bays, a root word letter bays, and change it for a pay, it goes up in strength of what the word of the meat, what the meaning is. So in the same way, on the right hand column, we change the first letter of the three letters from a bays, balal, to a pays, palal, we're going to see a stronger form of that word, which we'll explain. In the second column, it's in the middle word of the root. We change the beis from noval to a pei of nofal, and we're going to get a stronger usage of the word. Yeah?
All right, so I think you said that halal, you use the word judge.
Yes.
Is that also, doesn't it pertain to prayer?
Yes, we are going to see both of those things. That's excellent, yes. First, she's going to describe both of those. Okay, ready? I hope now, with this little bit of background, that was not, I know you might be confused now, which is fine. I'm hoping now as we read it in reverse, we'll actually see it become a little bit clearer. Okay, so I'm on page 212. Beginning with verse 7. Okay, the novla. Now again, the English of this verse, you see in the top of Rafersh, on the top of the page, he already uses in his translation, obviously, the way he's going to understand it. He does not read it as we had on that sheet that let us go and confuse their language. How does he translate it? Go to, let us go down so that their language will become dried up so that one may not understand the speech of his fellow. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were just reading that in Rafersh English, just reading the Chumash, you'd say, let their language become dried up? Mm-hmm. You can see why, if another translator even agreed with Rav Hirsch that the root of the word was naval, like that doesn't make anything. What does it mean for a language to become dried up? So therefore they would favor that the word navla really is based on the word bolo. In other words, the question here is, what's the shorish, what's the root of the word navla? So many of the commentators who translate it to mean confused mean that they hold that the root is the word bolo. Because to keep the root as it simply seems to be, dried up, of naval doesn't seem to make very much sense. Are you even more confused now than you started? No? So far you with me? So Hirsch is going to argue why naval, to mean dried up, actually makes sense, that the language became dried up. Here we go. Usually translated confused on the top of verse 7, now in Hirsch, on page 212. The navla is usually translated confused, which is based on the root of the word bolol. Except, says Rav Hirsch, that the root of this word is not bolol, beis lamed lamed. It's actually hava navla. It's nun beis lamed, naval. So which are now the next two lines of Rav Hirsch is arguing from a grammatical perspective why navla cannot be based on the word bolol. That's because there's no active form of the word bolol, which is all grammatical, which we're not really holding in the language of Hifil and Kal, of all the different languages. So therefore, Hirsch argues at the end of the third line, the word clearly comes from naval, not from bolol, but from the word naval, which means to cause to wither or dry up or fade away. Now, he argues something else now, that no further special action is required. The way the verse now reads is, Hava nirda, let us go down, vinavla sifasam, and their language will become withered. Meaning, so we could say, in our English language, we could say a couple of things. We can say, I'm going to go into my kid's room in order to get them to become quiet. That's my goal. Right now they're talking in bed. It's a half hour past their bedtime. They've been shepherding along. Oh, I want to go in and stop them from talking. So that can be done in two ways. I can go in there and I can say I'm going to go and talk to them why they need to be quiet because they have school tomorrow, so they need to stop talking so they can go to sleep. So that my presence there will not cause the cessation of their speaking, but I'm saying to you, I'll say to my wife, I'll go to their room and convince them to stop talking. Or I can say, I'm going to go in and my demeanor will be such that when I go in, they will stop talking. I will not need to do anything else, but my presence there will stop them from speaking. As it is in many instances in life. You know, if a rabbi or a shashiva, a judge, a policeman, when he stands on the road, cars slow. He doesn't need to do anything else other than be there, and the desired action results. Versus, If somebody wants to protest, they need to go and hold up a sign to get traffic to stop, because their presence alone has no impact, they're just a pedestrian. When they do some other action, their desired outcome will happen, right? It's very simple how those two things can happen. It says, first, the way the verse is structured, hava nerda vinavla, the usage, the grammatical form of vinavla means, I will descend, and as a result of my descent, their language will wither. It's not that anything else will happen, it's the parent saying, the demeanor with which I will walk into the room, immediately the talking will stop. I will descend, and their language will wither. Now, he's going to have to explain what is the connection between Hashem's presence descending into the people building this tower, but immediately upon his presence joining them, their language withers. So right now we don't know anything about what that means, just that he's saying that's what the verse is saying. The words mean, my presence will come down, their language will wither. Right? No further special action is required. The navla, the withering of their speech, is the immediate result of Yerida. Right? After all that, it's like, now his words make a lot of sense. I read this like over and over and over again. Okay, now at the end, it certainly does say, Kisham Balal, which means, now Balal means to mix, to create that mixture. So it says in the verse, two things are happening. God is going to descend. In his descent, the language will wither, and the result of a withering language will be a mixture of language. Because the Torah switches words. It went from Navla, which means to wither, to saying we named the place Bavel because there, Balal Hashem, there Hashem, mixed their languages. So that the procedure is clearly described with the word Balal. The procedure is going to become a mixture. And from this description, a procedure is called a confusion of language. But he's going to be bothered by the language of confusion. But this idea does not correspond to that which one usually takes this event to have been. It was to have been a division of languages, not a mixing of them. A mixing would imply that there were already different languages in existence which now were all mixed up, which is not what happened. There weren't many languages that got mixed up and confused. There only was one language. And besides, Balal never means simply intermixing existing ingredients, but the introduction of a fresh material to another and then stirring them so thoroughly together that in every particle of the old there is some of the new. So here there is not the slightest idea of confusion. And it's not confusion, it's a mixing. I'm going to cause to wither, and then through the withering of language, we're going to end up with a mixture. What is the mixture? An introduction of something new that's going to create a new type of mixture. But it's not a confusion of taking two languages and mixing them together. There weren't two languages, there was only one. We're going to add something through the process of withering. We're going to add something to this language, and that's going to create something new that was not understood one to another. Is that clear in terms of what's going to happen, even though it's not clear yet because we haven't read it, how that happened? Yeah? Here we go. 2:12, last paragraph now. Balal is related to Palal, or Pilel, or Lehit Palel. Now that's on that first column again, going down the list, how Balal changes from Pilel. Now what it first is about to do is go through the list. We went from Arev to Balal to Pilel. There's a progression in the language of various types of mixtures and combinations of forces. Balal, which is our word, what happened to their languages, is the concrete mixing of one substance into another. Right? That's the case of adding water into flour, creating something new, creating dough. It is more than simply arev, where the particles of the mixture are not incorporated into one unit. And a tarovis, a mixture, is where we have five pieces of meat. They are all distinct, but we don't know which one is which. Or a certain type of mixtures where we can see distinct particles, but they're all mixed up. Balal is different. Balal is where it's become something new. Flour and water are not particles of flour and water floating together, and you can't tell which one is which. It's a whole new entity called dough. As opposed to Orev, which is just taking various components and mixing them together. A cholent is a ta'aroves. There's the barley, and there's the potato, and there's the meat, but it's all mixed up. It's really hard to pull them apart now, but you can see there are components in the mixture. Now, there are other usages of the word orev. Orev, which means this mixture, means erev, nighttime, which you mentioned, which is the combining of day and night together in that in-between period. There's another word for orev, which comes up very often in halacha, in a very human form. An orev is a guarantor. If I want to lend somebody $1,000 and the person says, listen, all of your business endeavors have flopped. Every time you've borrowed money from me, you haven't been able to pay me back. I'm not giving you another $1,000. So I say, he's going to guarantee it. If you can't get it from me, you'll get it from him. And so-and-so agrees. I'll use an actual name. So Rick agrees to be my guarantor. So I want to borrow money from Ron. Ron says to me, no deal. You've never paid me back before. Why would I want to do now? So I get Rick to sign on. So that now if I can't pay, who pays? That's called an orev. Says Rav Hirsch, what's the connection between a guarantor and creating a mixture of entities? And now, listen to this. Just as out of erev, or orev, meaning a mixture, transposed to human society, what happens when we put that into human terms, this concept, we get the guarantor. The third party who comes between two separated people, because right now Ron and I are separated. I want something from Ron, and Ron says, no deal. So what does Rick do? He allows us to join together. Rick is the guarantor, is a third party, which when introduced to the relationship between Ron and I, which are now separate, brings us together. Standing in the middle becomes the uniting factor which joins them together. So Orev is a mixture, meaning we had two separate things, like pieces of meat which were totally distinct and separate. A taroves is when they get joined together in a way which I now can't distinguish them. So from that comes the Hebrew word orev, which says, Ron and I are distinct, we're separate, we can't get together. The guarantor, the orev, allows for there to be a mixture. Allows for us to work together because you bring us together where we want it to be separate. So far so good? Kol Yisrael, a raven, zelaza. All of the Jewish people are, so to speak, guarantors for one another. We're all responsible for one another. We all might want to be distinct, but the fact is it doesn't work that way. We all bring each other together in form of our halachic responsibilities and our obligations, right? The principle that says if I make Kiddush ready on Shabbos and you haven't heard Kiddush, I can make it for you again, even though I already did it. The fact that you have an obligation means I still have the ability to fulfill that, because if you have it, I have it, we have to all take care of it. I fulfilled mine, but I could do it for you. And as far as various different applications of all the Jewish people being connected to each other. Okay.
The word aravim, does that also fit into this? A multitude of not clearly one group, a multitude of...
Yeah, I'm sure. I understand. Okay, so that's Arev. Arev is a mixture. Bolol is a stronger mixture, and that leads to the third strongest, which is Polol. Says Rav Hirsch, in the same way of Polol, the stronger form of Bolol, we get the word judge. Listen to this. The judge, oh my goodness. Oh. The judge brings a factor which stands outside the contending parties, which can look impartially at the matter. We have two parties, they're fighting, they can't get together. This one says this one says that. There's no way to bring them together. So what do we do when there are two parties who can't get together? You bring in a third objective party who's going to join two fighting parties. So this impartial factor looks impartially at the matter, lets this objective consideration penetrate into every aspect of the case, and thereby settles the dispute and brings together those that were standing apart and opposed to one another. Now, with this he's going to say, is the Torah's view of the role of a judge is very different than the way ordinary, in his words, people would look at what a judge does. Two people are fighting. What's the role of the judge? Says Rav Hirsch, the ordinary way of looking at the matter is that the parties have gotten themselves entangled with each other, and the judge decides and separates them. That justice is something dividing. That right now you can't, we're all mixed up, you can't figure out, and that justice is going to separate and put this one there and that one there. However, says Rav Hirsch, according to the Jewish concept, injustice divides, justice unites. It's when there's a lack of justice that causes the division. Now there's fighting. When you can bring justice into the matter, and Balei Din are mekabel v'din, they accept the judgment, and they see, this is truth, this is what the judge or judges have rendered, that's a uniting force. And therefore, Pilel, the word for judge, is the strongest sense of creating a mixture. Because when there's dissension, when the two parties are fighting in court, they are separated. In the same way as a guarantor brings together the third party so that they can function and have the loan, Bolol is the additional third additional element creating a new mixture like dough. Judge is the strongest form of taking two warring factions and with his objective new insights rendering a judgment which the justice allows the two to come together again in peace. This is the truth, and we will now have a way to deal with it as opposed to our, we don't know what to do, and that's what causes the fighting. So far so good. Therefore we get the language of hispalel, to pray, from the same language of pilel. So also hispalel, to get oneself completely penetrated with all that is godly, which should be the ruling and forming factor for mankind in every direction. Meaning just as a judge penetrates as the objective party, every aspect of the case with his objectivity to be able to bring them together, his palel is bringing godliness into oneself to penetrate every aspect of their life to be the ruling and forming factor of our behavior. In prayer, the Jew becomes his own judge in the sense of bringing in the godliness to penetrate his behavior to understand what it is that he is supposed to do to be at peace with himself. Okay, back to the language issue. Now, if this is the meaning of balal, meaning introducing an external factor to recreate something, then here too something must have come into the formation of their speech which hitherto had no influence on it. Beforehand, whatever this new element was irrelevant. It was a non-factor. But now, something new has been introduced, and this new element must by itself have brought about that people no longer understood each other. Meaning, Hashem comes down, and the language withers naturally. And as soon as you've introduced this new faction, this new withering of language, then on its own, the people no longer can understand. Something happened with the introduction of this new element that did not allow for the people to understand each other. The effect of the entry of this strange element, meaning this new element, into the way they formed their speech is primarily called naval, meaning it withered. The withering of the language was the way in which the new element was introduced. And then the result of that was bolol, was a mixing of the new withered language. Just as bolol is the beginning of polol, so is novel the beginning of novel. Now here's where he's going to explain what I've already said. That which later affects the fall begins in the first stage with withering or drying up. A flower becomes withered as soon as it begins to be separated from the source of its thriving. And when you cut the flower from the ground, it begins to wither. As soon as the canals which join the source of life to the canals which form the flower become contracted, poetic way of saying you've cut off the roots of the flower from the nourishing ground, from the flower itself, the flower begins to wither. And when the connection entirely ceases, the flower falls off. So here, as soon as God came down, the language became separated from the source which hitherto had formed it. That line is going to be the key. This is what he's now going to get himself into a long discussion of, which we're not going to finish for sure, but we'll hopefully begin to introduce. God comes down, we introduce the process of God into it, and now the language is called to wither. Now, withering as he described it through the analogy of the flower, means I had a flower attached to the ground, attached to its nourishing source of all of its nutrients and its water, and now it's cut. So when it's cut from its source, it begins to wither and eventually fall. When God comes down to the people, the language the Torah uses is that language withered. So what would it mean that the language withered? It means it began to be cut off from its source. What is the source of language? The language that they had particularly, Lashon HaKodesh, the Hebrew language, was God Himself. God was the source of the Hebrew language. We've discussed in this class and many others that the Hebrew language is different than all other languages, that it was not just a convenient agreement of sounds to mean certain things. As we said many times in English, the word chair and table could have just as easily been reversed. When the English language developed, it could have been decided that chair should actually be a reference to what we call a table, and the word table could be a reference to what we call a chair, and nothing would have changed, nothing would have been different. Languages are just agreed upon sounds and symbols to mean and represent certain things. And that in Hebrew, it's not that way. In Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh, the language is like the periodic table in chemistry. The language means the essence of what it is. A horse, a samach, and a vav, and a samach, to spell the word sus, is the essence of what a horse is. So that all the, when Rav Hirsch goes through the Chumash and says the word pilel refers to a judge, the essence of what the shorish means of the word defines what a judge is. Every Hebrew word is in the essence of what it is, and therefore the language is pristine and unique in that it came from God and has all of the godly connotations and meanings of the words. If a language is called or said to wither, that means it was in some way cut off from that source. It was no longer attached to the source which gave it its meaning, and it's now been detached, and it begins to wither as it's no longer connected to that source. So that when God descended, He did something in His descent, so to speak, that caused the language to be cut off from its source. Yeah.
It's interesting, in Hebrew, I think it's the only language, like in history, that's been able to be fully revived. So it meant that there's some life force still
sure,
left.
Sure, 100%, yeah. Right. Okay, so we have like 6 minutes left, and I can't believe it. So let me start outside a little bit. He's going to get back into something which he touched on earlier, and he's going to get back into it now in much greater depth as far as let's read the first couple sentences. We'll use that as our introduction. What are the elements that form words and language? Says Rav Hirsch, what creates language? What is it? There are, or at least there can be, two. An objective one and a subjective one. We can have a language which is objective. This is the word that's used to define something is the essence of that which is being defined, which is the most pristine form of language. And you have a subjective language in which the word chosen to refer to something is my understanding of what the object is. Meaning I'm no longer defining the whatever the object is that I want to define based on what it is, but on the way that I relate to the object. So that, for example, let's just take an example from the Chumash that I'm making up on the spot, so I hope it'll end up being a good one. When we name someone, we can name someone based on what the child is, so that the name that we will call this particular child is objective in defining the child, or the name can be what the child means to me, how I see the child. So that it's not defining the essence of the child, it's defining my relationship to the child, which is done very often in the Chumash. In other words, the child, the name, especially of all the Shvatim, the 12 tribes, as they're born, their mothers give them names which refer to what the child means to them. Shimon, Ki Shoma Hashem, Hashem heard my cries. So that doesn't define the objective essence of Shimon in as much as it defined his mother's relationship to Shimon. This represents Hashem's listening to my call. And in our language, in our name, we do that all the time. So there is an objective essence of the thing and then the subjective essence. In the development of language, we're going to see a lot of subjective naming of things, that the way that things will be named will define the culture that gave it that its name, how the culture related to the word that they're using. Make sense so far? We can think of a language, says Refersh, meaning the naming of things and their connections, being formed from what things are in themselves and what their connections are in the world in general, meaning objectively. The name that we give to something is simply an accurate description of what it is. This is what the object is, and this is how it relates to the world. There is no personal agenda in when I name the object that it's something good. I'm just defining this is what it is. Or, subjectively, I can define something from the special point of view which the nation may have of things and their relationships. We're just thinking of an example right now. It's a playoffs, like the word Super Bowl. So the word Super Bowl, to define the final game of the football season to determine the champion, is an interesting word. Is that objectively describing the game being played, or is it the value that the culture and that the football league has put on it by calling it the Super Bowl? Right? It's a value. What makes it super? What makes it, right? We created a system, and it truly is at this point super because we made it and we value it as super. In other countries, they could care less about this particular game, but it's become something because the word Super Bowl doesn't define the game. In other words, if we would have called it the final, if there'd be a word which would describe the final game of the season to determine a champion, that's an objective description of what it is. It's not saying that it's anything other than the final game to determine who wins the season. But we call it something which doesn't objectively describe it, but it puts some subjective meaning to it. I think I'm hoping that's an accurate description, but I'm trying to just get into what he's determining in terms of how we name things. In the languages now prevalent, it is only seldom that we find words in the different languages which were formed from the same point of view of looking at the thing. So meaning he's going to bring an example, but we don't find in different languages that the word for an object comes from the same place. For example, the word judge. So the word judge, or let's not the word judge, the concept of a judge. Every language will have a word to express the concept of a judge, to express the concept of an individual who is appointed to sit and hear two sides of an argument and decide what to do. Right? That concept should be run across all cultures and all languages. If you break down the different languages, what word do they use to define that person? So in English, it's the word judge. In Hebrew, it's the word shofet. In German, which is the native tongue that Refersh is writing in, it's apparently the word Richter. Excellent. Which is what he's going to write. What is the shorish? Where do those words come from? In other words, we have three words which are all used to express the same thing, right? The person who decides a case. Richter, judge, shofet. But what's the root of those words? The root of that word will express what the culture understands the role of the judge to be. In German, says Rav Hirsch, for instance, take the word judge, which we have just been considering. In German, Richter, am I pronouncing that right?
Richtung.
Close?
Richtung.
Richtung? Well, he's going to do that. Richter, the one who gives things the direction from Richtung, in which they are to turn, he decides the Entscheid. Entscheidend, I don't know. Separates this here and that there. Now, I'm taking his word because I don't speak German. The root of the word judge is one who gives something direction. Where do you turn? What direction are you going? And therefore, he decides this should go here and that should go there. It's a placing of a direction. In Hebrew, the word judge is called a shofet, which comes from the word uniter. Justice is a mishpat, the creation of a harmonious order, from the word safas, shofad, shofat, which places everybody where he ought to be in conjunction with the other party. Then when you take all the other parties there, the shofet is the one who creates a harmony amongst all the parties so that they function together. It's one who brings together. This is what Rav Hirsch was arguing earlier, that injustice is divisive, justice brings together. So which means it's a nuance. Is the word for judge one who just gives direction, or who one who creates order? Now they're similar. They both, the judge has a role. But there's a nuance of the language as to what the role of the judge is. Tell this person where to go, what direction to be in, or looking in the big picture to place order in a harmonious whole amongst the parties. He brings one other example which we will conclude with for today. In German, the word bad, schlecht, seems to come from the word schlichti, which means simple or unpretending. So that everybody who does not want to be bad must not be geschlacht, or geschlacht, as they say in yeshiva, right? Geschlacht is he's bad. He is uncommon. He's very simple. He's not sophisticated. So the word bad is rooted in a word of simple. So if you don't want to be bad, what's the opposite of being bad? Being sophisticated. Which would mean that cunning would be the quality for strife, or I would use the word sophisticated or cunning. Whereas in Hebrew, what's the opposite of bad? Yashar. Comes from the word of being straight.
Yeah, but being simple is tam.
Right.
And Yaakov's tam, you know, that it's considered a very good thing.
That's correct. Okay, we're gonna have to stop here. The idea that he's going to be addressing, again, I can't speak to the German language, so I can't. He's obviously much more well versed in German, so you can. And you can say.
We have
first
teacher.
So hold on 1 second. On that. You can do a comment first. I'll complete. Yes.
I want to make a comment to
Lista,
because Lista, as the infinitive,
yeah,
is the infinitive of judge, and means making right. And when you translate right to German, it's richtig.
Yeah.
All right, so you have this meaning also.
Meaning you're arguing with what he's saying. And I can't, in terms of the German language, that the meaning is,
yes,
is more to turn right, not to just, he's claiming that just means to give direction. I mean, I can't argue. I mean, I don't know the language.
Right. Yeah,
richtig is right and correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct and opposite of left.
Right.
Okay.
So you're arguing. You're
saying it is Phil's advice. It is what you're saying, Phil.
So you're arguing with him, or you're agreeing with him?
I think he agrees with him. It seems like you would agree because it's separating. It's making one wrong and one right.
No. I just want to add that Richten, as the infinitive of what a Richter does,
yeah,
means making something right, putting into the right direction,
mm-hmm,
and right. It's richtig. So richtig is the adjective of richten, of richter.
Which is making correct.
Yes.
As opposed to, he's saying it's more just in terms of giving direction,
yeah,
and you're saying it's giving direction, but the sense is in the correct direction, not just a direction, but the correct direction.
Yes. So
which is fine. Yeah, I don't think I'm talking with him. In other words, he's claiming that the Hebrew is not just giving the correct direction, but it's a uniter. In other words, in the German language, I agree with you. In other words, it is to give direction and to give correct direction, but not for the agenda of unifying the parties, just in the sense of I have a dispute. My job is to give correct direction in this dispute.
Yeah, so it's a uniter because they go together.
But he's claiming that the root of the word is not to unite,
yeah,
it's to give the correct direction. There's a problem here. I have two warring parties. Factions can't agree. My job as the judge is to give the correct direction. The root of the word shofet in Hebrew is to bring together in harmonious whole. So that it's a different goal, even though they both are supposed to give the right response. The goal is not to give the right direction, but to unify.
But we just said that
German is not Lashon Kodesh.
Right.
It has only the meaning by the usage of the word.
Right.
And the usage of the word is that they are put into the right direction.
Correct.
So you don't have any root. What is the root of the German word?
No, that's what he's saying. In other words, I agree with you. I think we're saying the same thing, that the root of the German word for judge is describing his role, which is to place in the right direction. The root of the Hebrew word for judge is to unify, which is a different root. He's not saying it's bad or good. He's just saying that's what it sounds to me. Saying. I can't argue whether that's true or not in the German language. I don't know. Just that the word which developed for judge describes his role as giving the right direction, and the word in Hebrew for judge derived from a word which means unified the warring factions.
Yeah, referring to what you said earlier, Hebrew words put together, and it's it is a divine language, but in German you don't have this. You
right.
use the word how it is used, and this is
His point.
Yeah.
That's his point, that it's in each, we'll see more, in each culture, the words they chose are those, that's where it comes from. Yeah, we'll get to that. Okay, so he's going to be arguing in terms of, I hope this wasn't confusing, we didn't get very much done today. In terms of what happened to their languages, in terms of what the withering means, how that's going to create a mixing of language from that withering, and why it's not necessarily a confusion, but a mixing, and why that was done, and how that was done, which we're in the middle of. We'll continue Mirat Hashem next week. Okay.